Daniel Silva is one of the truly great American spy novelists. Daniel burst onto the scene in 1997 with his electrifying debut, The Unlikely Spy, a novel of love and deception set around the Allied invasion of France in World War II. His second and third novels, The Mark of the Assassin and The Marching Season, starred two of Silva's most memorable characters, CIA officer Michael Osborne and international hitman Jean-Paul Delaroche. But it was Silva's fourth novel, The Kill Artist, which would alter the course of his career. The novel featured a character described as one of the most memorable and compelling in contemporary fiction, the art restorer and sometimes Israeli secret agent, Gabriel Alon. The heist is 14th in the Gabriel Alon series, and it is, quite simply, an incredible read. Welcome, Daniel. It's great to have you back with us on the Book Report.
Thank you for having me.
What I find so extraordinary is that Gabriel's expertise never spills over into superhero caricatures. Your books are so incredibly smart.
I appreciate that. You know, he's a little bit larger than life, and when necessary, he can be do things that ordinary mortals might not be able to do. But generally, I like to populate the story with believable, real characters, and that the combination of these believable, real characters make extraordinary thing happen on the page.
Right. The heist is so current. It's so pertinent. It seems like you wrote it based on yesterday's events. So, congratulations.
I'm cursed, I suppose, with being on a very tight deadline. And I've never been one of these writers that's been able to get, you know, a manuscript or two ahead. And I actually finished the final revisions on this book, believe it or not, on June 1st. And so for better or worse, I do, have the ability to keep the books very current in terms of what's really going on in the world.
Right. This book begins with an art theft of a Caravaggio nativity. And it's based on an actual theft, is that right?
That is correct. It is the Caravaggio's nativity with St. Francis and St. Lawrence, one of his final great altarpieces. He painted it in Palermo when he was on the run, wanted for murder. It hung in a small chapel in the center of Palermo until a evening in October 1969, when two thieves entered the chapel, got it from its frame, and no one other than the thieves has seen it since.
You share a really surprising statistic in the book. Each year, thousands of pieces of art go missing, and the value of the stolen pieces is estimated at $6 billion, making art crime the fourth most lucrative illicit activity in the world. Talk right. about that.
Well, it is, as I wrote in the book, I mean, it is an extraordinarily large sum of money. It's not all paintings, but paintings, other objects of art, $6 billion. And so it's, I guess, drug trafficking, arms trafficking, money laundering, and then art crime. And so I think for a long time, people tended to dismiss art crime as sort of a crime against the rich, but it really isn't. But more importantly, I mean, each time a thief makes off with an iconic piece of work, a little piece of our history gets taken. And, you know, the odds of recovering a painting once it's stolen are extremely small, 1 in 10. So unfortunately, when a painting is gone, it generally stays gone.
You described stolen art as traveler's checks for the criminal class. Is this based on fact?
A lot of art does sort of stay in the hands of criminal gangs and get circulated back and forth between criminal gangs. And it's, oftentimes it's used as down payments or collateral in other criminal transactions. So a criminal gang that's buying a load of heroin from Turkey, for example, might, hand over a Van Gogh or a Picasso as collateral. And so that's one way that art circulates through the criminal underworld.
The heist puts the spotlight on Syria and the Assad family. Can you tell us why you wrote about this right now?
Well, I didn't actually name the Assad family in the book. They are unnamed rulers of Syria. But I think that one of the most interesting aspects of the, Arab Spring, the Arab Awakening, is the way that it laid bare the personal finances of some of these rulers. I lived in Egypt. I knew that President Mubarak was a wealthy man, but it was estimated that, at the time he was driven from power, that he was worth $70 billion. Muammar Gaddafi was worth at least that much, if not more. And the Assad family is also worth billions and billions of dollars. That is money that was not spent on their people. That is money that was looted, diverted through other shady deals. And there are governments that are looking for it, professional assets hunters are looking for it. And if we can get control of that money, we might be able to influence their behavior.
You're listening to Daniel Silva on The Book Report. The Arab Spring briefly held the promise of change in the Middle East, but sadly, it seems to have reverted back to old ways. Do you see any indication of a more optimistic outcome?
I am hopeful, and I think that we have to hope. Otherwise, it's just too gloomy. But I'm afraid that things are going to get worse before they get better. In fact, I'm almost certain of it. So we have a long way to go before the Arab world sorts itself out, unfortunately.
There's a character in the book, Jihan Nawaz. Tell us her story a bit, and also Hama Rules.
Well, Jihan Nawaz is a young woman who works at a private bank in Linz, Austria. The bank is co-owned by a man from Syria who is involved in concealing assets of the Syrian ruling family. And Hama Rules, where she comes from, the town of Hama. Hama Rules refers to the massacre that took place in Hama in 1982. There was an uprising by the Muslim Brotherhood in Hama. The Assad regime responded with absolute brutality, destroyed the town, killed about 20,000 people. And afterwards, that response became known as Hama Rules, meaning that if you rise up against me, I'm going to respond with just unrelenting fury and violence. And I think Hama Rules was a predictor and a precursor of what would happen when the Arab Spring finally arrived in Syria.
This book has scenes in Austria, Corsica, Geneva, and of course Israel. Did you travel extensively while preparing to write?
Absolutely. I always do. I always visit the places that I write about. And this book was no exception.
Oh, it seems like you've laid the groundwork here for Gabriel to take over his agency. Is that going to happen in the next adventure, and are you already at work in it?
I learned a long time ago not to discuss a book that hasn't been written, but he is going to be a father soon, and he is going to be the chief of Israeli intelligence soon. That's all I can say.
Do you ever consider writing a non-Gabriel thriller in the near future?
I do, but, the series is, quite frankly, so wildly successful and is still growing that if I did that, I think that there'd be an uprising among my readers. And so for the moment, I plan to continue writing Gabriel.
Oh, we're very glad.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Thanks. Bye, Daniel.